How much is a song worth? It depends on who you ask, but we'll try to get to the bottom of it on this week's Radio Berkman. How much are 24 songs worth to you? 70 cents a piece, 90 cents a piece, maybe $1.29 if you're after the new Jonas Brothers album on iTunes. How about this figure?
$3.6 million.
That's how much the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, sought from one alleged file sharer whose case went to trial last week. The case of Jamie Thomas Rassett, a Minnesota mother accused of sharing 24 songs on the peer-to-peer file sharing network Kazaa in 2005, has in the last month or so accelerated like a mixtape in Fast Forward. Defense attorneys Kiwi Camera and Joe Sibley took on Thomas Rassett's case pro bono in late May. Thomas Rassett went to court on June 15th, and Ars Technica reported the verdict on the 18th. Thomas Rassett found guilty of willful infringement with a $1.92 million penalty, about $80,000 per song. Seen as something of a bellwether for battles over music and copyright, the results of the Thomas Rassett case might read as a major blow to those opposed to RIAA litigation. Those of the estimated 35,000 file sharers charged over the last 5 years who have yet to see their day in court may see the $1.92 million penalty as motivation to settle with the RIAA for more paltry $3,000 to $5,000. But with a deeper look into the tactics and the limited areas that this verdict covered, this case might paradoxically strengthen the resolve of record industry opponents. For one, the issue of how the RIAA collects their evidence against the file sharers, and whether it is even legal and constitutional, didn't even come up in courts this time around. David Weinberger spoke to lead Jamie Thomas Rassett defense attorney, Kiwi Camera, shortly before the trial to give us the lay of the land.
So she's been sued by the record companies as part of the RIAA's ongoing campaign against people who download music online. We took the case 4 weeks before trial. We filed a series of pretrial motions, jury instructions, and all that stuff. But the most interesting of those motions is a motion to suppress all evidence collected by MediaCentury, which is the investigative arm of the RIAA's litigation campaign. MediaCentury has collected evidence in this case and in each of the other cases in violation of the federal wiretapping statute, the federal pen tracing statute, and in this case, the Minnesota Private Detectives Act. The lawyers for the RIAA and the recording companies, including their litigation counsel, supervised and directed MediaCentury's activities, and in doing so violated the rules of professional conduct, which forbid acquiring information in violation of the rights of the third party. And we're asking the court to suppress all the evidence that MediaCentury collected, which we think would put an end both to this prosecution and to all the RIAA's other prosecutions.
I'm a little confused about how this generalizes. What is it that they did wrong that, in your claim anyway, that they're doing in all their cases that would put an end to all the cases?
Yeah, MediaCentury collects the evidence that they use in each of their cases. So MediaCentury is how they get the list of files that they say each of these defendants downloaded and shared. And what MediaCentury does on the Kazaa network, although it works on all these file sharing networks, MediaCentury will set up an instance of Kazaa, will hunt around for files available on the network that appear to be songs, and then they'll run a separate program which intercepts the packets traveling between the two media, the two Kazaa instances, one on the defendant's computer and one on MediaCentury's computer. They'll take those packets, get the IP addresses off them, and use those to bring their Doe lawsuits to identify the owner of the IP address, and then one of these cases gets filed. Now, that act of interception of the packets going back and forth between the Kazaa instances is a violation of the federal wiretap statute. It's the sort of thing that if you want to do it, you've got to get prior permission by a court, so on and so forth.
So this case already went to trial. What's the difference between the two cases?
Well, it went to trial once, and after the jury returned its verdict, the judge held that he had made a mistake in one of the jury instructions and that he didn't require proof that a third party had actually downloaded the music from Jamie in order to support a finding of copyright infringement by distribution. The old jury instructions that the judge set aside would have permitted a conviction based on Jamie's making the songs available for download. The new jury instructions are going to require that a third party actually have downloaded the songs from Jamie. So in order to get a copyright infringement conviction this time around, they'll have to prove that third person.
Will they be able to show that somebody actually did download the songs from Jamie's computer?
I have not seen any evidence of that.
And presumably that would require yet more intercepted packets to show that some of them were coming off of off of her machine, not to somebody else's.
That's right. The only way the RIAA identifies anyone using the Kazaa network is by violating the wiretap act. It's interesting because it's hard to think of another example of a litigation campaign like this in the history of the federal courts. And that's what's driving all the other people who are so upset by what's going on, because it just strikes them as not something that should be going on, that an industry is able to engage lawyers and threaten individuals, most of them without counsel, with possibly multi-million dollar jury verdicts, and use that threat to cause more than 30,000 people to pay settlements between $4,000 and $12,000. And obviously, that's a strategy that succeeded, because it's only now, more than 5 years into the litigation campaign, that one of these cases is going to trial. And what that group of people has been looking for, I think, is a hook, a legal hook, for saying why that litigation campaign is inappropriate and why it can't proceed in court. And this is one of the, I think, very good hooks. And it's that the whole strategy that they've come up with, the lawyers, the recording industry is media centric, to collect this evidence is illegal. And that's why we think, you know, a district judge exercising his discretion, looking at the kinds of prosecutions that are being brought and the lack of defense counsel in most of these cases, I think it would be a wise exercise of discretion for a judge to make sure that the plaintiffs in these cases really dot their I's and cross their T's, and here they didn't do it.
The rest of the cases have settled rather than actually going to trial.
That's right. And really, almost all of us would settle if we were faced with $3.6 million in potential liability, protracted and expensive federal litigation, and at the very beginning they say, hey, you can get out of this for $4,000. Almost all of us would settle. And almost all of us have settled. And that, indeed, is the RIAA strategy. They don't want cases like this to be tested by either a vigorous legal defense or a vigorous trial. That isn't what these cases are about. These cases are about scaring people and extracting these, four or five figure settlements quickly.
The RIAA has announced that it's no longer going to bring these suits. How many cases are still pending?
You know, I actually don't know the answer to that. I know that there are a substantial number of other cases pending. In fact, we represent the defendant in one in the Northern District of Ohio, Brittany English, which was filed in March. I don't think it's of course very good if the RIAA stops bringing these cases, but that doesn't change the fact that using this legal strategy, they've collected more than $100 million in settlement monies from these defendants that they shouldn't have collected. One thing that Charlie and we and others are doing is putting together a class action against the RIAA to recover that $100 million, which we think was improperly extracted from people by these threats that are based on inadmissible evidence, a statute that we think is either inapplicable or, if applicable, unconstitutional, so on and so forth. So we haven't reached the end of the RIAA story.
Okay, that's very interesting. Would there possibly be some form of penalty on top of recovery of the money?
There might well be. I mean, our primary goal is to get the $100 million back and send a message to anyone who is thinking about using the federal courts in this way as a kind of intimidatory small claims court where you can force people to pay a couple thousand dollars by threatening them with federal litigation that would cost, you know, over $100,000 in lawyer's fees to get to trial, and then the threat of a giant judgment. What we're trying to do is tell people that that kind of thing shouldn't be tried. And I think, you know, forcing them to disgorge $100 million will send the message. And if we can get more than that, that's spectacular.
You're representing Jamie Thomas pro bono, that is for free.
Yes, we're representing all of the RIA defendants whose cases we're working on pro bono.
Why?
Well, we, you know, part of our practice, we take pro bono cases like this where we think there's an important legal issue and where we think the effects of the particular case will be far-reaching. And that's just part of our view of what lawyers should do. In our paying practice, we focus on people's kind of most difficult, novel cases that span multiple areas of law. So we focus on hard stuff. And we think that in our pro bono practice, we should similarly focus on hard stuff that has a broad effect. And these cases are right up our alley.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, David.
Kiwi Camera is the lead defense attorney in the recording industry's case against alleged file share Jamie Thomas Rassett and a partner in the firm Camera and Sibley. Since the trial, Camera has said that they will be appealing the charges. For links to more information on this story and past episodes of Radio Berkman, visit us on the web at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Boston.